This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host and managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. Good government must have as its core purposes the achievement of results for its citizens. This underscores the critical importance of performance, accountability, and results in government management, and it's premised on the belief that citizens have the right to hold the federal government accountable for its performance. Today, the U.S. Department of Energy stands at the forefront of helping this nation meet its energy, scientific, environmental, and national security goals, developing and deploying new energy technologies while reducing dependence on foreign energy sources. How are federal agencies such as the Department of Energy managing for performance and results? What are the critical elements that make for a great strategic plan? And how have the Recovery Act and the GPRA Modernization Act of 2010 changed the way government departments operate? We'll explore these questions and so much more with our very special guest, Jay Hoffman, Director of the Office of Program Analysis and Evaluation within the U.S. Department of Energy. Welcome, Jay.
Great. Well, thank you for having me, Michael.
Before we delve into specific initiatives, perhaps you can provide a brief overview of the history and evolution of Energy's Office of Program Analysis and Evaluation. When was it created and what's its mission today?
Well, the office came about in 2002. I arrived roughly December 2005, and it was originally modeled on the Department of Defense's Office of Program Analysis and Evaluation, which is actually sort of a famous office in PA&E circles. It was a concept that was largely devised by Secretary McNamara. And I think the DOE really hoped to emulate that when it stood up its PA&E capability in 2002. Now, the key difference between the Department of Energy's PA&E and what Defense is doing is that Department of Energy's Program Analysis and Evaluation function is located in the office of the CFO, whereas at the Department of Defense, it's located in the Secretary's office. And why that matters is that our PA&E is really a subsidiary of the CFO's organization, meaning that we are grounded in budget, taking a multi-year perspective, trying to understand the value proposition of various alternatives and how the department's $26 billion research and development portfolio fits together. I think at the end of the day, our long-run value proposition is trying to help integrate a very complicated Department of Energy story and communicating that story through the planning and budget process.
So operationally, just a quick question around how your office is organized and how many FTEs do you have?
Well, in my organization, we have three divisions: a strategic analysis division, which really does the core program analysis and evaluation work that would be analogous to what I just talked about at DOD. We have a second division called performance management, and they are responsible for all things Government Performance and Results Act related, the strategic planning, the performance management processes. And then lastly, we have a temporary division in PA&E that was stood up in 2009 called Recovery Act Operations. The entire operation is between 25 and 27 feds, and currently about 7 contractors are, although at our height in recovery, we probably had 3 or 4 times that many contractors. Budget-wise, this year, I would say the non-recovery side is probably $4 to $5 million. The recovery budget is probably $2 to $3 million, and that's been coming down quite a bit since 2009. Everything we do in Recovery Act is severable with the idea that we will shut that down at the end of next year. Now, you juxtapose that to when I arrived on the scene in 2005. The organization was 12 people. only $130,000 in contract travel and training money. It really has sort of lost its footing. So I do feel good about the foundation that we have, and I think we've built some exciting things.
So I'd like to delve into that. In your specific role as director of Energy's Office of Program Analysis and Evaluation, what are your specific responsibilities and duties? And more importantly, how do you support Energy's overall mission?
Right. So at the end of the day, I think the way to conceptualize what it is we're doing is we're trying to provide an independent look, independent analysis of alternative portfolio options. So that helps the decision maker sort of weigh their options between what might be two or three very good ideas, but there's only funding to really accomplish one or two of those things. And so we're trying to help sort that out. We don't have any sort of line responsibility for implementing these things, so we don't have a dog in the fight, so to speak. I think in addition to that, we also facilitate the identification of priorities and provide a programming framework in terms of how some of those things ultimately get selected for the planning process. We're doing a range of independent program, technology, and market analysis. A lot of the DOE's work at the end of the day has to fit into a larger economy, and that's a fairly complex proposition. Obviously, we have the facilitation of the strategic planning process. We play a role in helping formulate and implement that with the senior team. And then the roles that you would expect from the performance improvement officer, specifically monitoring the performance measures and targets, and the Work and Recovery Act, which is around the planning architecture, the data management and reporting associated with that. So maybe the way to think about this is a day in my life. You know, it requires strong conceptual analytical skills, and I might find myself in the morning working on alternative budget proposals for, say, something like nuclear power, nuclear deployment options. And then in the late afternoon, maybe I'll switch gears and find myself working with OMB on our high priority performance goals, both in terms of what we're trying to deliver programmatically as well as getting the right process in place to execute those. And finally, maybe before I break for the day, we'll be doing something with performance measures in terms of looking at those, seeing what our results are, and getting those upstairs to our leadership team for review. So it's a pretty diverse mix of things. It's an interesting day for sure.
So with such a diverse portfolio, what are your top three challenges that you face, and how have you sought to address them?
Sure. Well, you know, I would think about it this way. Challenge number one is around really recruiting and retaining top talent and what has unfortunately become sort of an acidic climate, I think, toward the federal bureaucracy. And that's just the nature of things. That ebbs and flows. Certainly the cap on pay and some of the bonus restrictions that have put in place haven't helped. The Recovery Act implementation is an interesting dynamic in that as well, and that I think the federal workforce worked very, very hard to implement Recovery Act, and now that's become sort of a political talking point and not necessarily the best way. And finally, you're seeing a lot of calls for downsizing, and I think the retirement wave that people have been talking about being 5 years around the corner for the last 10 or 15 years is finally starting to break. So recruiting and retaining top talent is probably the number one thing on my mind and occupies at least 10 or 15% of my mind space every week. Next, I would say, is staying current. This is a rapidly evolving market, and we have rapidly evolving technologies. And that's really what the Department of Energy is all about, is working on innovative technologies. And so I think it's a real challenge for the people in my organization in particular, as well as the entire Department of Energy, I suppose, to stay current on what we're doing on the innovation side in research and development. By its very nature, the concepts that we're dealing with are complex, abstract, they're worked in niches, and all those have to be sort of married against what's happening in a rapidly evolving marketplace with smartphones and changes in the way that we use and think about energy, to name but a few. So there's a constant learning curve there. And then lastly, I would say that there's a balance that we're trying to strike between taking the long view and what we hear in the talking points as the urgency of now. Certainly there are some problems that need to be solved now, but they're not all likely to be solved on the watch of one secretary or one administration. And I think we need to strike the balance. I need to help strike the balance to cultivate and maintain institutional capability and to invest in our people to make sure that we have the right skill mix and analytical foundation to help the next crew that comes in, whoever they may be. I guess I would say one thing. I think that this will be harder and harder to do as the budget pencil gets sharper and sharper.
I'd like to transition a little bit to learn more about you. Could you tell our listeners a little bit about your career path? How did you get started and what brought you to your current leadership role?
Well, it's been an interesting path, I think. I started actually at the Department of Treasury in 1997 as what was then called a presidential management intern. And my first assignment was at the Bureau of the Mint, which at the time was a very different type of government organization. It was very atypical, and it's greatly influenced the way I think about problems in the federal sector. So let me say a little bit more about that. At the time that I arrived at the Mint, they were just making this transformation to operate more like a business. They'd gone to Congress and sought legislation to move off of appropriations and onto a revolving fund. They had a product line, which they sold to the public, and they were very focused on trying to generate a profit and maintain margins. They put up a retail website when the term retail website was something people were just starting to wrap their heads around. They had a surprisingly creative and innovative set of leaders at the Mint that were very savvy with the Hill and could get some things done. And so we were right on the cutting edge of these programs that people had not heard of at the time, crazy things like the 50-state quarter program and a new dollar coin, and getting to see how all of those things were put together, focusing on the analytics that drove that business and thinking about customer service delivery using technology was something I don't think anyone else in the government was doing much of at that time. So that really influenced the way that I thought about government, the execution of government policy and mission and agency performance. Now, from there, I moved on to the Treasury headquarters for a couple of years and spent time with both the Assistant Secretary for Management as well as the Secretary's Chief of Staff. And that was also very impactful, and then that gave me the foundation in what are the responsibilities of the cabinet officer, the role they play, and what sort of levers are in place that influence those activities below the cabinet level. So that was a very different focus. It was very different than working in a bureau where you're focused on service delivery or process. From there, I actually went back to the Mint and spent another couple years building their financial analysis capability, looking at the operations of the Mint in the context of both what they were doing, but also in terms of the marketplace. We were very interested in market trends, things like was the economy booming or busting, because that affected the business model and our bottom lines. And from there, I received my first SES position about almost 8 years ago at the Department of Treasury in a strategic planning and performance management. One of my supervisors there, second line supervisor, was a fellow named Sam Bodman, who was our deputy secretary. And when he went to the Department of Energy, I started applying for jobs there and was lucky enough to be there starting in 2005 in my current role.
Well, wonderful. Given your experience and the diverse experience, what are the characteristics of an effective leader in an increasingly interconnected networked world?
Well, I think the thing you have to think about in terms of a networked world is, first and foremost, you have to embrace it. You have to be part of it. It's now woven into our fabric of how we communicate. As an example, Secretary Stephen Chu of the Department of Energy has a Facebook page and a large following. And he's using his Facebook page not just to sort of share photos of his recent vacation, but he's using it in a way to communicate his priorities and the reasoning behind those priorities to an audience that he might not be able to reach. So I think that's an exciting use of sort of the networked world and networked communication. The other thing I think that's equally important that the government's starting to wrap its arms around is that there are big productivity gains for government if it can figure out how to leverage this new networked world. The federal government is now able to reach out and touch its citizens through the power of technology, through the web, and directly in a way that we really couldn't imagine 10 or 20 years ago. So I think that's exciting. And I don't know about you, Michael, but I'm waiting for the USA apps for my iPhone as we think about this brave new world.
How is the U.S. Department of Energy managing for performance and results? We will ask Jay Hoffman, Director of the Office of Program Analysis and Evaluation within the U.S. Department of Energy, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. What are the seven management imperatives all government executives need to know? How is DoD improving its business operations? What is FAA's next generation air transportation system, or NextJet? How is New York City shaping a government that is customer-focused, innovative, and more efficient? And what about power, security, and leadership in the 21st century? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. We bring you insights and interviews from government executives who are changing the way government does business. Download or order a free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Jay Hoffman, Director of the Office of Program Analysis and Evaluation within the U.S. Department of Energy. Jay, an agency strategic plan provides a roadmap to the future, as well as offers assessments for progress towards a particular vision. And this is quite important given the diverse portfolio of the Department of Energy.
To that end, would you highlight energy's strategic goals and management principles that both frame and inform the department's strategic vision, as well as the performance framework that turns this vision into a reality?
Sure. Well, first, let me begin by saying that the Department of Energy's mission is extremely diverse and not particularly well understood outside the walls of the Department of Energy. In fact, I think a lot of people, and perhaps even myself included, upon arriving at the Department of Energy, find that energy is one of four things that the department does. It's not intuitively obvious what it is that we do in energy. So when you look at our strategic plan, the first goal you would probably expect to see there, and that's about energy, and that goal is about the department's role in catalyzing a transformation of energy technology and the way we use and generate energy. The second goal is one maybe that's not as intuitively obvious if you're not familiar with the Department of Energy, and that is our goal in the basic sciences. The Department of Energy has a large infrastructure of national laboratories, and innovation as a cornerstone to economic prosperity is something the Department of Energy is very focused on, and we're investing more than $5 billion a year in the basic sciences, some of which are not related to energy. Third, and this is the one I think the public probably knows the least about, but it, believe it or not, is the largest part of our mission, and that's nuclear security. The Department of Energy is the stewards of the nuclear weapons stockpile. So we have a goal on both the maintenance of that stockpile as well as the nonproliferation goals that the president has called for in his Prague speech. And then our last goal revolves around management. How are we using our corporate infrastructure to enable the mission of the department? I would also point out that I think one thing that's particularly useful in this strategic plan is we have what are called targeted outcomes that go beyond the goals with more specificity. And these targeted outcomes outline what performance we expect to see by when explicitly in the strategic plan, and there's approximately 50 of them. And just a few examples of what these are, things like securing all vulnerable nuclear materials worldwide in 4 years, reducing our legacy environmental footprint by 90% by the year 2015, and things like that where you really have a target by date certain. Now, you'll notice that up to this point, I haven't said anything about gas prices. I haven't said anything about oil markets or energy exploration or electricity delivery to your home, and that's intentional because that's not what the Department of Energy does. We're more focused on research and development. But there's certainly things that touch your life, and so maybe I'll give you a couple of examples that might be of interest to your listeners. We do an awful lot of work in the areas of biology, astronomy, physics, supercomputers, weapons research, advanced materials, and energy. One of the most well-known projects that we partnered with the National Science Foundation on was the mapping of the human genome. That research had its origins in not just the Department of Energy, but our predecessor agency, the Atomic Energy Commission. And it had started out as looking at the mutations that happen in your genes when they're exposed to radiation. And that research became the foundation upon the Human Genome Project. The batteries for the lunar module were developed at Department of Energy laboratories, and the hybrid cars that you see in the HOV lanes every morning, the battery technology for those was something that was also supported and developed by the Department of Energy. So a great diversity of technology that you can find not only on the sci-fi channel but in your everyday life.
Well, it's interesting. I want to follow up with exploring the actual process in formulating a department's strategic planning process. Could you tell us a little bit more about how you go about doing that at Energy?
Sure. Well, first I would say that every strategic planning process that I've been involved in has been different. And I think that has to do with it's important that the process itself fit the style and comfort zone of the leader of the organization. That gets them to buy into the process and participate. Now, the process that we just concluded at the Department of Energy, I think, met that criteria. It was led by the Undersecretary for Science, Dr. Steve Koonin, which I think was a brilliant selection, someone that really had a deep foundation in science and what it is the Department of Energy did. We supported Dr. Koonin in those efforts. I'll talk a little bit about that. But the process involved a series of workshops, town hall meetings, soliciting a broad range of stakeholder input, And that culminated in then a drafting of the plan, which was, you know, considered to be highly inclusive. And the end result, because they reached out, I think, so well to the scientific community, really resonated with the scientific community. So it wasn't just a plan that communicated to the Department of Energy and its employees and contractors, but outside the walls of DOE to the stakeholder community beyond us. Now, my organization helped with a lot of the preliminary work in terms of assembling a candidate list of priorities, looking at and assembling technology targets, some of which I mentioned in the prior answer, as well as putting together a structure for the actual plan and figuring out how to connect it to operational processes within the agency once it was done. Now, the Secretary of Energy was very involved. He led an offsite at the Blair House, an all-day offsite, which was pretty exciting to be a part of. Unlike some strategic plans that I've been involved in, he actually drafted his own message. So if you're interested, I encourage your listeners to read that message. It's a 4 or 5 page letter, open letter, really, about how he thinks about the energy problem and what the Department of Energy should do. And it was a lengthy process. This isn't something we threw together in a few months. It actually took us a year and a half from beginning to end to formulate the plan and move it through this inclusive process that I've described.
I'd like to understand a little bit more about the high priority performance goals of energy. How do these goals relate to or complement the department's strategic goals, which you outlined earlier? And more particularly, how do you track and manage progress made around these goals?
Well, the Department of Energy currently has 7 high priority performance goals that we started working in earnest to implement in 2009, and they are as follows. One is to reduce our legacy environmental footprint by 40%. Another is to ensure that the nuclear weapons stockpile will work if it's called upon. A third is to implement the president's call to secure all loose nuclear materials worldwide, all vulnerable nuclear materials worldwide in 4 years. Another is to double renewable generation capacity over the 2008 baseline by the end of next year. Yet another was something that came from the Recovery Act, and that is to help enable the battery manufacturing capability of the United States to sort of get off the ground and be capable of supporting up to 500,000 hybrid vehicles a year, plug-in hybrid vehicles a year by 2015. The president since re-emphasized that goal in the State of the Union last year. We had hoped, although we fell short on this particular goal of having 2 conditional commitments for loan guarantees for new nuclear reactors in this country by the end of last year. A number of complicating factors, including the accident in Japan, slowed that one down a little bit, understandably. And then lastly, weatherizing 1 million homes by the end of 2013 for low-income and disadvantaged folks through some of our programs there. Now, you'd asked how these 7 are represented in our strategic plan, and the way we handled that is each of these 7 goals we view as an explicit targeted outcome, and they are verbatim in our strategic plan as a targeted outcome within each of the goals. I think that's important because there's no gray area in terms of how we're inferring these priority goals. How do they connect to the strategic plan? They're in the strategic plan. They're in its fabric. In terms of how we go about implementing them, each of these high priority performance goals has a goal leader. They have an action plan with key milestones, critical path milestones that we need to hit in order to be successful. And we have a range of performance measures that we track on a quarterly basis and talk to senior management about, including the deputy secretary, to make sure that we're on track. The last thing I would say is that some of these are no-kidding national priorities, things that the president has talked about, his nonproliferation goals, his call for doubling renewable energy, the efficiency goals in terms of weatherizing more homes, and putting 1 million alternative fuel vehicles on the streets by 2015.
So, Jay, you've mentioned the Recovery Act a couple of times, and I'd like to switch gears and talk about energy's approach to its recovery appropriation, which I believe was around $35.2 billion. You were instrumental in tracking and managing energy's Recovery Act progress. Would you tell us a little bit about the effort in this area, and more particularly, what lessons have you learned, and how have you implemented them in energy beyond the Recovery Act effort?
Well, let me begin by saying that the Recovery Act was an unforgettable and transformative experience, not just for me, but for the entire department. When you look at that $30-plus billion investment that was made in the Department of Energy, That was not on top of just a $25 billion appropriation. The areas that received Recovery Act funding had base appropriations of less than $15 billion. So you're talking about something that was almost a 3x increase in one tranche of money to focus on a set of problems. Now, what my role was around establishing the planning, reporting, and operational framework that we use to implement Recovery Act, the mechanics of it. The work actually started long before the Recovery Act was passed. I remember a late night November meeting before President Obama's inauguration, but after the election, meeting with members of his transition team to brainstorm and to provide analysis on possibilities for the legislation, what different types of programs might we want to put forward and recommend that had a strong analytical underpinning. That meeting went into the wee hours of the morning, as I recall. The second thing that really stands out is while most of Washington, D.C., which I'm a proud citizen of, was down on the mall watching the president getting sworn in, I was at home with a very pregnant wife trying to stay warm, but working on a white paper that ultimately became the call to action for what my organization did. 8 days later, I had presented this paper to the CFO, and he quickly told me to get started in implementing it. And this became the basis for how we projectized the Recovery Act into 150 discrete projects once the legislation was passed, and we went through a process with the secretary on that. And the idea was to really make our corporate information systems, which were put in place in 2005, so they were relatively modern, to make that investment sweat in a way that we were not making it sweat in our day-to-day operations. You know, would you believe that the coding architecture that this modern financial system uses has its origins in a 1940s set of processes? I found that out and it just boggled my mind. So one of the things we did in recovery is we tried to leverage the modern capabilities and coding of the system and really integrate things together. Well, what were the results? We were able to do real-time 24-hour refresh reporting on Recovery Act with very little human intervention. I don't know that any other agency could do that. Not only did we do a lot of dashboarding in terms of the 150 recovery projects, we also did a lot of work in terms of geospatially mapping data. So we could look at a map of the United States and literally look at problem areas and try to address them by zip code. We had a very rigorous planning architecture that went far beyond what was required from the OMB guidance, having detailed implementation plans for each of the 150 projects. We did weekly reviews of these projects. So 150 projects, we didn't do all projects every week, but every week there was a review on a handful of projects. And that really established an operational cadence that I think has carried on into the base programs in sort of a post-recovery world. It was a lot of hard work. There was a time where my office would open at 6 in the morning and close between 3 and 4 a.m., so we were only closed about 2 or 3 hours. But it was all worth it. I think the Office of the Vice President at one point referred to DOE as the gold standard when it came to how we were managing our data, how we were doing our reporting, and how we put our systems together.
Well, I'd like to transition from the Recovery Act to the GPRA Modernization Act of 2010. Would you tell us a little bit more about GPRA Modernization Act of 2010, and what are some of the essential components of this law, and how does it build on the foundation of the Government Performance Results Act of 1993?
Okay, well, the new law, I think, makes some nice fixes, and it's a very pragmatic approach to doing strategic planning and good project management. First, the new law requires that the federal government establish government-wide priority goals. And this is something I think that is very useful, trying to figure out what are the two or three things that are really, really important at a government-wide level that we're trying to focus on right now. And then that cascades down to institutionalizing this concept of high-priority performance goals. The new law requires that agencies have priority goals, somewhere between 2 and maybe a dozen, that they're shooting for in a very narrow time frame of 1 or 2 years. I think this provides a lot of clarity into how agencies budget and is the next logical step from a strategic plan. It revisits something that I think agencies got away from, and that is requiring an annual performance plan. But the way that the law conceptualizes this plan, it's really more of an operating plan if you read the law. And I think that's healthy. How are we going to get from point A to point B? What is your plan? It requires quarterly reporting. and reviews, and actually calls out the chief operating officer, which in most agencies is the deputy secretary, to be involved in those reviews and to lead those reviews. And the new law also makes a call for more transparency, not just more reporting, but making that data and information available via the web on a quarterly basis. In terms of how it builds upon the 1993 law, it moves the strategic planning cycle to a 4-year cycle. It was a 5-year cycle. If you think about it, the president just happens to get elected on a 4-year cycle. So it ties that election cycle with the strategic plan. Again, a stronger focus on implementation. I think the original law had a very strong emphasis on the front end, on the planning, but not as much on the back end, on execution and implementation. A lot more rigor around monitoring and the quarterly reviews. And the last thing I guess I would mention is that it creates institutions within the agency and provides more legitimacy by spelling them out in the law. So, for example, the idea of a performance improvement officer is now codified. Mm-hmm. The idea of a chief operating officer is now codified. The Performance Improvement Council is now something that's called out in law. And this, all of this combined, raises the stature of the initiative and draws more attention to it, and I think makes it easier for the agency to go about implementing it because they're paying attention.
So, Jay, as a follow-up, to what extent does the GPRA Modernization Act rest on a systemic resourcing process? And more particularly, what ways does the Recovery Act approach provide agencies with a template for GPR modernization implementation?
Well, this is something that I've given a lot of thought to. And in my view, the Recovery Act was the GPRA Modernization Act pilot program. And let me say a little bit about that. In the Recovery Act, we had established a few priorities: create jobs and reinvest in our economy. These are very analogous to the call for high-level federal goals. In the Recovery Act, there was a tremendous focus on planning architecture in the guidance. You had to have an agency plan, you had to have program area plans, and then ultimately the Department of Energy chose to have project-level implementation plans. Very analogous to the new GPRA modernization law that calls for strategic plans, annual planning, and annual reporting. Very much in line. The next piece was reporting. In Recovery Act, there was an heretofore unheard of cadence on reporting and transparency. There were weekly reports, monthly reports, annual reports. The transparency was something that was absolutely unheard of. And the messaging from the Office of the Vice President that led recovery all the way down to the program line staff that was leading it was lockstep. Everyone was using a like set of data and focused on that. Now, looking at GPRA modernization, you see this call for quarterly reviews, quarterly reporting, more transparency, more reliance on data. Again, I think the two concepts are very well linked, and the lessons from recovery are apparent. Next is a call for more transparency in trying to reduce reporting burden. In Recovery Act, you saw websites like recovery.gov, federalreporting.gov, where you had recipients actually report in information, a focus on looking at data to identify low performers. All of these things are part of the GPRA modernization. And GPRA modernization, what are they saying? They're saying try to move more of your data to the web. Try to leverage your systems. Try to identify low-performing programs and help either, one, help them perform, or two, make a decision to move in a different direction. Lastly is organization. In the Recovery Act, you had a senior accountable official that was on top of recovery and sort of the Recovery Act czar for each agency reporting into the Office of the Vice President. And that created a legitimate institutional structure by which to implement recovery. Same thing in GPRA modernization. What do they do? The law says that you will define who your chief operating officer is, and that person will be supported by the performance improvement officer. And that is your apparatus for creating the institutional capability to monitor the execution of your program. So, again, I think that the Recovery Act was a great pilot for GPRA modernization, and I do hope that the performance community will really embrace the lessons learned from Recovery Act and try to learn from them as they go about implementing it.
How have the Recovery Act and the GPRA Modernization Act of 2010 changed the way federal departments, such as the Department of Energy, operate? We will ask Jay Hoffman, Director of the Office of Program Analysis and Evaluation within the U.S. Department of Energy, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. What is FAA's Next Generation Air Transportation System, or NextGen?
How is the U.S. Department of Homeland Security turning its one DHS vision into a reality? What is New York City doing to shape a government that is customer-focused, innovative, and more efficient? And how is the DoD improving its business operations? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. We bring you insights and interviews from government executives who are changing the way government does business. Hear from FAA Administrator Randy Babbitt, DHS Undersecretary for Management Raphael Boris, New York City Deputy Mayor for Operations Stephen Goldsmith, and Dave Winogrand, Assistant Deputy Chief Management Officer at DoD. Professor Joseph Nye and General Anthony Zinni on power, security, and leadership in the 21st century, and seven management imperatives that government leaders should pursue to be successful in an era of fiscal constraint. All of this and so much more in the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine. Download or order a free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Jay Hoffman, Director of the Office of Program Analysis and Evaluation within the U.S. Department of Energy. Jay, GPR modernization requires the agency chief operating officer to conduct quarterly reviews of high-performing goals. Who is Energy's COO, and what is the role of the performance improvement officer in supporting the COO?
Well, at Department of Energy, we're very fortunate in that our Deputy Secretary, Dan Poneman, is the COO of the agency. I'm the PIO, the Performance Improvement Officer. I view my key responsibilities to the COO as follows. I am the person that is monitoring and facilitating data flow for our high-priority goals, catalyzing and creating an environment to do our data-driven reviews, and then monitoring the implementation of the strategic plan at a corporate level. And certainly there's line managers that are responsible for the actual implementation of their responsibilities. Now, I would say that in normal times, you see senior political teams spend a disproportionate amount of time probably on the planning and budgeting phases of their job. And that's not unexpected. That's where the policymaking happens in a federal agency. However, in these austere budget times, there is a new focus on not just planning for the future, but making do with what we have. Spending well is a new priority, and getting the most productivity possible out of every dollar that's been appropriated to us. And that's where I think these quarterly driven reviews that the Deputy Secretary is responsible for leading and delving into the operational mechanics of the agency are incredibly important and, quite frankly, incredibly valuable. And we've learned an awful lot about doing these data-driven reviews in the Recovery Act. And so in some respects, the timing is good because we're well-versed in it and transitioning well. Now for me, I have three goals that I'm trying to pursue in supporting the COO. One is situational awareness on the data that governs the organization. Two is trying to identify issues early before they become a crisis so that we can adjust. And then lastly is cleaning up systemic execution issues. We have a lot of sort of silliness with our data, and it's not to say the data is bad, but just a lot of things that really need to be looked at and cleaned up, and so trying to have the best data possible for the decision maker.
So I'm interested. You've been the performance improvement officer and served in this capacity under very different leadership and different leaders at Energy. Could you give us an insight onto how you've tailored your approach to this role to fit the leadership of the department?
Sure. Let me begin by saying I think the PIO helps facilitate the selection of the priorities, the formulation of the strategic plan, the monitoring of performance, and the things that I mentioned before. In terms of how I think about the role, maybe the simplest way is that the PIO has to be the conscience of the agency in a lot of respects. The PIO needs to be the person that asks the question that everybody else is thinking. For example, is what we're talking about really a priority? Do we realistically have the resources to succeed at what we're proposing? Are the measures that we're proposing meaningful? Do they tell us anything about the operations of the organization and whether or not we're attaining the goal? And are we all rowing in the same direction? I think it's so sort of questions of conscience that the PIO has a seat at the table for and a responsibility to find a way to ask. Now, how you go about asking those questions is somewhat dependent on the leader of the organization, and I've certainly tried to calibrate my style to support whomever the secretary and the deputy secretary are at the Department of Energy, and their personality governs a lot of that. I think it's also important maybe to just take a minute and step back and think about, well, where have we come in this whole evolution of performance management since 1993? Because I think that also influences the way that I tackle the PIO role. And I will tell you, Michael, that I'm really more optimistic than I am pessimistic. And let me tell you why. I think it's easy to get caught up in a short-run view, but when you look at the long run, I think a lot of progress has been made. When we first started working on these issues in the mid-90s, the conversation was around defining terms. What is a goal? What is a performance measure? What is an outcome versus an output? And that has really changed. And now what we're doing is we're talking about how do we use the strategic plan as a vehicle for the cabinet officer to implement his or her policy agenda. We've moved from trying to define terms to conducting data-driven reviews on our programs. I think the executive order that President Bush signed in 2007, establishing sort of the Performance Improvement Initiative, if you will, was a good start and established an operational framework and raised the profile of the performance management function. And the new GPRA law that was recently passed codified a lot of that and rationalized the concept of performance management. So I think at the end of the day, there's been a tremendous amount of progress made in the last 15 or so years. And it's an exciting time to be working in this area.
So, Jay, Energy uses numerous metrics to assess how well it's accomplishing its various program objectives and overall strategic goals. Would you outline several of those initiatives being pursued by Energy to consolidate and, more importantly, streamline its performance assessment systems?
Sure, Michael. Well, I guess first I would say that one of our guiding principles is something that I've heard Jeff Zients, who's the deputy director at OMB, say quite frequently. And in fact, he hasn't attributed the quote to me yet, but I'll forgive him. He's often said that in order for a performance measure to be useful, it needs to be used. And I am a big believer in that. And that is something in my 5-plus-year run at the Department of Energy, I've really tried to impress upon the program managers that provide performance measures for our performance management system. Hey, if you're going to have a performance measure, make sure that this is something that's on your desk that you find useful. I also think it's important that we be data-driven, that the results that we have are founded in data, grounded in data, I should say, and are trendable. I've also started to become a big believer in less is more. We need to be able to recognize the distinction between data-forward decisions and data is just sort of a reference tool. There's a difference, and I think sort of sorting through some of that noise can be very helpful. We've actually used the new strategic plan as a convenient excuse, an important one, to go and revisit all of our performance measures. And we're about two-thirds of the way through, with the idea being, what are the measures that meet the criteria that we've just been talking about in terms of data-driven, trendable, useful, and which ones best tell the story. And in doing that, we've been able to reduce the number of performance measures we have by about half. And the ones that are left are, in my view, of a higher quality and more instructive nature in terms of what the department is doing. We actually took the unusual step of not submitting our performance information with the budget this past year. We ultimately did submit it a couple of months late, but we felt so strongly that we needed to get this right that we didn't rush it. We actually notified Congress that we just needed a little bit more time to finish. And hopefully they think that the wait was worthwhile. Certainly they'll see the fruits of that in this next budget that we're putting forward. So those are some of the things that we're focused on at the Department of Energy, and we'll see.
Jay, I'd like to get a better understanding of how Energy links performance management with costs and investments. And specifically, what steps are you taking to track and manage costs that link back to performance so you can recommend a better investment mix and optimize benefits?
Well, there's a lot going on in this area, and it goes beyond what's just going on in my organization. The first thing I would mention is I'd go back to these 50 or so targeted outcomes that are in our strategic plan that we talked about earlier. There's been a real emphasis the last couple of years to articulate what we want to do and when we want to complete it. And having that simple boundary condition in place is critical to asking the next question, which is, and what is the plan to achieve that result, and how much is it going to cost? I've actually come to the conclusion that this is a fundamental building block to budget and performance integration. And for whatever reason, that has been sort of an elusive goal that we've been talking about for a long time, probably 10 years or so now. And I think about the president's management agenda from the prior administration, and I wonder if not having this focus on targeted outcomes was one of the missing ingredients in terms of our success or lack thereof, in terms of being able to link budget and performance. Second, I'd like to mention work that is happening specifically at the Department of Energy in relation to the question you asked on aligning intra-DOE institutions to accomplish these targeted outcomes. The senior leadership team at the DOE has established what they call technology teams. And what they're doing is they're trying to align work across the sciences, the energy program areas, deployment mechanisms, and they're establishing and communicating an integrated plan to achieve the expected results. So it goes beyond just performing analysis in terms of how do budgets relate to the strategic plan and really getting down to brass tacks of what do we need to do, how do we need to create linkages across institutions to get there. An example of one of these teams is something I had alluded to earlier, is they have established a goal to have electricity produced at $1 a watt by the end of the decade by solar power on a commercial scale. You say, okay, well, that sounds kind of interesting. What does that mean? Well, if successful, what that would mean is the ability to produce solar power at a commercial scale that is cost competitive without government subsidy to something like coal or natural gas. And that could be very transformative for the energy economy.
So, Jay, you've done a wonderful job highlighting the complex and diverse program portfolio of energy. And I have to understand that a lot of the things that you're doing in terms of program analysis and evaluation really rest on analytic techniques and how you approached these areas. What are you doing to build your analytic capability within your office?
Well, it starts with recruiting. It starts with people. We would rather bring in people with technical expertise on energy, national security, science, and train them on program analysis, budget, performance management than the other way around. These topics are very complex. Consequently, the types of people that you will find on my team are highly educated, having PhDs in many instances in physics, mathematics, public policy, engineering, and similar disciplines, really very technical disciplines. Now, I have made a real push in the last 4 years in particular to bring in people with not only a deep technical knowledge, but quite frankly, a deep passion in these areas so that they have a strong incentive and a personal interest in staying current. I'm also very interested in getting my people more involved with the actual technical work that's happening in the program areas. It's one thing to be in a role like mine where you're doing sort of interesting analytical research and analysis, but you can very quickly become disconnected from what's actually happening. And so I've tried to emphasize to the best that we can of getting involved, traveling to our laboratories, meeting with the scientists, understanding the fundamentals of the technologies that we're working on and the technical challenges, economics, and market forces that these technologies are trying to compete within. I want our staffs to understand what the DOE is trying to do and why they're trying to do it. If we're going to have a conversation around our priorities or be advising on strategy, I think that's fundamentally very important. And let me give you an example. We talked about the high priority performance goals earlier, one of which was doubling renewable energy generation in, I believe, a 4-year time frame. If you think about the analyst responsibility in that goal, it's not enough for the analyst to just sort of track the goal. They need to understand fundamentally what is going on in the energy economy. They need to understand the policy mechanisms that drive energy deployment, things like the investment tax grant, the production tax credit, how the DOE loan program plays a role in clean energy deployment, what is happening with the price of energy for competing energy sources relative to renewable power, understanding how all of those things fit together, and then making a determination, are we in fact on track to doubling renewable energy generation in this country? So it's a pretty diverse foundation that they have to have, and that's been my focus.
How has the renewed focus on performance led to more accountability and enhanced program outcomes? We will ask Jay Hoffman, Director of the Office of Program Analysis and Evaluation within the U.S. Department of Energy, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. Each edition of the Business of Government magazine has as its focus the core mission of the IBM Center, connecting research to practice as a means to improve public management. We do this by bringing together insights and perspectives blended with an equal measure of practicality and reflection from an array of government leaders, public managers, thinkers, and practitioners. Hi, I'm Michael Keegan, managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. In an era of fiscal contraction, today's leaders face unique challenges that present many difficult choices. It is a period that, while imposing many constraints, simultaneously confers as many opportunities to make a difference, introduce new ways of managing, explore pragmatic approaches, and pursue management imperatives that help government leaders perform in an ever-challenging, complex environment. In our latest edition, we bring you conversations with FAA Administrator Randy Babbitt, outlining the Next Generation Air Transportation System, or NextGen. Rafael Boris, DHS Undersecretary for Management, discusses how the department is turning its one DHS vision into a reality. Stephen Goldsmith, Deputy Mayor for Operations for the City of New York, discusses how the city is shaping a government that is customer-focused, innovative, and efficient. We offer perspectives on power, security, and leadership in the 21st century from Professor Joseph S. Nye Jr. and General Anthony Zinni, former commander of the U.S. Central Command. Our forum presents seven management imperatives that government leaders must pursue to be successful in this new environment. All of this and so much more in the Spring-Summer 2011 edition of the Business of Government magazine. Download or order a free copy at businessofgovernment.org and find out how the business of government is not business as usual. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Jay Hoffman, Director of the Office of Program Analysis and Evaluation within the U.S. Department of Energy. So, Jay, I have the pleasure of talking to many of my guests about the use of collaboration and partnerships among agencies and with the private sector to achieve mission results. What are you doing to leverage partnerships and collaborate to improve operations at DOE?
Well, the things that we're doing at DOE certainly go beyond just the work that I'm doing. The strategic planning process that I mentioned before, as well as the yet-to-be-finalized quadrennial technology review that some of your readers may have read about, have involved a number of town hall-like meetings to try to solicit a broad range of informed opinion about the things the Department of Energy is working on. Now, one of the things that we've heard from our stakeholders, and I think this has been interesting in terms of the importance of partnership, is one of the most important things and useful things that the government can provide is information. Turns out that it has a tremendous impact on the way consumers and businesses make choices. And if you think back to your Economics 101 class from college, that makes a lot of sense because competitive markets function best when information costs are low and we're in a near-perfect information situation. In the grand scheme of things, providing information is actually relatively inexpensive. Now, what does that mean? How does that affect decisions? Well, in terms of the Department of Energy, the government can provide data on the benefits of different energy efficiency technologies, and that data can lead to fundamentally different choices by consumers in terms of the doors and windows and light bulbs and homes that they buy. And that can have the same effect as some of the research that we're trying to pursue at the Department of Energy. I'd also say that the Recovery Act catalyzed a lot of idea sharing and networking and collaboration. The enormity of the recovery challenge, not just from the Department of Energy's perspective in terms of trying to implement something so large, but the entire federal government, it was a big initiative, I think resulted in a lot of new networking across agencies, a lot of best practice sharing, that we were all in this together, and I think a lot of good came from that.
Well, Jay, I'd like to understand, given your critical mission of your office and of your department, what are you doing to ensure that you have a well-trained, technically capable workforce?
Several years ago, when I was at the Department of Energy, a cabinet secretary, Secretary of Treasury, said to me and others, there are fundamentally three questions that your employees need to be able to answer yes to every day when they walk in the door. And they're as follows. Am I treated with dignity and respect? Do I have the tools and training I need to do my job? And am I encouraged to make a contribution, and did anybody notice my contribution? He said, if you can answer yes to those three questions every day, you'll have a world-class organization. So let me go back to something I said earlier. It starts with hiring the right people. If you can get individuals with a passion for the mission and a solid technical foundation, you are way ahead in terms of meeting the challenge that you've articulated in your question. Second is you have to make it a priority. I want to position my organization so that the staff can answer yes to that second question about having the tools and training they need to do their job. I think everyone in my staff knows that the training budget is the first line item that I allocate funding to every year. So it's not something that we try to figure out how much we can afford. It's given the training budget, what else can we afford? That sends a powerful message to your workforce. So the staffs know that if they commit to working with their supervisors, formulating a development plan to build their skills, that the dollars will be there.
Well, from your perspective, Jay, how has the renewed focus on performance led to more accountability and possibly enhanced program outcomes?
Well, first, I think that the evolution of the strategic plan is a fundamental tool for the cabinet secretary to articulate a set of priorities and then communicate those more broadly is a huge driver in terms of how the performance culture has evolved. Having the cabinet officer standing behind a set of very concrete things that they want to get done can do nothing but augment the performance management area. Second, and we've talked about this a little bit, I think that the Recovery Act lit the way on a lot of this. At DOE, there were three distinct Recovery Act phases. There was the planning phase where we were trying to figure out how to do this. Once we had it planned, we entered to phase two, which was what we called the obligating phase, is getting this money onto contracts. And then the third phase is actually executing the dollars and getting value from them. Now, in that, there was a lot of data-driven management, data-driven results, data-driven reviews, and I think all of this was important to establishing an operational cadence in recovery. We certainly knew what the goal was. The goal was to obligate $32 billion in 18 months, and that was an all-consuming process, and then to actually get results from this. So accountability and success through obligation were clear-cut, and if we didn't succeed, the money would end up going back to Treasury. Now, in my view, the next phase of this is linking all of this to people, right? So we've got the secretary focused on this. The Recovery Act has taught us a lot. Now we need to get this into the everyday lives of every employee. And I'm talking about connecting this in a real no-kidding kind of way, all the way down into flowing into the standards of our line staffs. In order to do this, I think we're going to need to work closely with agency staffs, the unions, human resources. This should be viewed as an opportunity, not a threat. I think at the end of the day that agencies and staffs that can demonstrate they are delivering their mission and adding value will have a much better time in an austere appropriations environment than those that cannot demonstrate this. So at the end of the day, I think it comes down to people, and I think that's the next big phase.
So, Jay, what advice would you give someone who's considering a career in public service?
First and foremost, I think someone who's considering a career in public service needs to be able to articulate what it is that they hope to contribute in public service. How do you envision yourself making a difference? And I think you need to be realistic about where you can make a difference. The answer is probably not Department XYZ or the government. The impact and experience that you can have as a federal employee in most instances is very different than the contribution and impact you can have at a state and local level. And just it is not better or worse, but it's just different. And I think understanding that distinction is important. So for example, if you're interested in education, it's a very different prospect to work for the county of Fairfax as a teacher than it is to work as a program analyst at the Department of Education. Now, that said, I think the federal government is a terrific opportunity, particularly for people interested in policy and advanced analysis and research. However, you're two or three steps removed in a lot of cases from the delivery of the actual service and the citizens that you serve. And I find that for some people, when they're choosing public service, they miss this distinction. And so, again, I would just articulate what it is you want your contribution to be and then figure out where best you could make that contribution.
Well, Jay, I really appreciate your time today. I've enjoyed our conversation. But more importantly, I appreciate your dedicated service to the country.
Well, thank you very much, Michael. I enjoyed being here.
This has been the Business of Government Hour, featuring a conversation with Jay Hoffman, Director of the Office of Program Analysis and Evaluation within the U.S. Department of Energy. Be sure to join us next week for another informative, insightful, and in-depth conversation on improving government effectiveness. For the Business of Government Hour, I'm Michael Keegan, and thanks for joining us.
This has been the Business of Government Hour. Be sure to visit us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. There you can learn more about our programs and get a transcript of today's conversation. Until next week, it's businessofgovernment.org.
How is the U.S. Department of Defense improving its business operations? What is DoD doing to modernize its business processes and to use resources more efficiently? And how is the DoD promoting management and operational excellence? Join host Michael Keegan as he explores these questions and much more with his very special guest, Beth McGrath, Deputy Chief Management Officer at the U.S. Department of Defense. It's next week on the Business of Government Hour.